Great, if you can make sure you've got Ecclesiastes open in front of you. It's going to help us all. And the outline hopefully will give you some help as we go through. I don't know if you've watched the 2008 film A Bucket List. The film Bucket List is about two terminally ill men who break out of hospital to do all they want to do before they die. Kick the bucket, I guess, is the idea, the bucket list. And the film starts like this. I think it's Morgan Freeman. He's, I've got his voice. I haven't, obviously. It's difficult to understand the sum of a person's life. Some people would tell you it's measured by the ones left behind. Some believe it can be measured in faith. Some say by love. Other folk say life has no meaning at all. What I can tell you for sure is that by any measure, Edmund Cole, who's the other guy, lived more in the last days of his life than most people managed to wring out of a lifetime. You know, last week we learnt the realism, didn't we, of the preacher who taught us that life is frustrating. Life is frustrating, we learnt, because it's short and it's elusive. You just can't kind of control it. Short and you can't control it. And he taught us by observation. He showed us from nature. He said, look at the way that the sun does its stuff, and you know, and the wind and all that, and the rivers. He showed us from nature. He showed us from our senses. Look at your eyes and ears. They never have enough, do they? And then he looked at us, showed us history. You know, generations come and go and come and go and come and go. And he asked this question: who actually gains anything? Who ends their life with gain, given that that life is short and it's elusive? It's just kind of can't grab it. At the end of the day, his point is the brevity of life and the enigma of life, the kind of puzzle of life, rob us of any lasting impression or profit. Now, we might be thinking that whilst that's true for most people, there are some people who've made a pretty impressive mark on the world, haven't they? What about Bill Gates? What about Freddie Mercury, if you know who he is? What about Muhammad Ali? And there's a point, you know, some people really do know who those are, but actually lots and lots of people don't. Now, if there's someone who we think could claim to have made a gain in life, surely, if you've got your Bible eyes on, King Solomon is the one. You know, you think about King Solomon. We thought about him in 1 Kings chapters 1 to 10. It's an extraordinary time in Israel's history. He was so wise that kings and queens came from all over the world just to listen to him. His wisdom brought him wealth. He built palaces. He built a temple. The people were happy and united. He judged justly. Now, this is a golden age, wasn't it? Literally. Surely Solomon and all those others I've mentioned are an exception to the claim that life is futile. Well, I think that's where the teacher takes us next. What he showed us by observation last week, he shows us this week by experimentation. Look at verse 12. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. He pursues his bucket list, we might say. But in doing so, he exposes, and we'll see this, the emptiness of sucking the life out of life. He shows us a better way. Life is a gift to be enjoyed, not gain to be pursued. And his point really is to encourage us to enjoy life. Enjoy it as gift, not as gain. Well, what is wisdom going to teach us? At least three things. Firstly, that God has permanently frustrated life. Secondly, that lasting joy is an illusion. Thirdly, that life is gift and not gain. Let's think about the first of those. Wisdom shows us in verse 12 to 18, particularly, that God has permanently frustrated life. And let's just consider a few things from what he writes. Look at the first verse there. This reality, I've said, is from God. Verse 12b, is tells us what the teacher has found. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. You know, wisdom, what does wisdom show us? Wisdom shows us that the frustrations of life are God's doing. God has laid this on mankind. Now, we thought a bit about that last week, because even though the preacher doesn't talk about God in the first 11 verses, really, that is what his point is. So we saw, didn't we, that life is frustrating because God has made it that way. Remember the verses from Romans. The whole of creation has been subjected to frustration. Now, in saying that, of course, we're also saying a couple of other things. We're saying it wasn't always that way. That's not how God created the world in the first place. When you read Genesis 1 and you think about Adam and Eve and the work and the garden, there was no frustration there. There was nothing frustrating about Eden. But creation has been subjected to frustration after its creation. Of course, the Bible fills that out for us, doesn't it? The rebellion of Adam and Eve, their sin, their being kicked out of the garden affected creation as a whole. So that even now, we say, creation is frustrated. My point is this, that this reality is from God. God has laid this on mankind. Secondly, and perhaps slightly surprising, it's an evil thing in some ways. When it says, what a heavy burden, more literally, it reads, it's an evil task. This is an evil task. This frustration is not in itself a good thing. And we don't have to pretend that it is or call it in itself good. We can call it what it is. It's an evil. It's not that God is evil or that God has done something evil, of course. But this frustration of life wasn't meant to be like that. It's a foreign intrusion into the God's created order, as it were. And I think also implied, when we know who God is and we know his plans, is that we can be sure that one day it will not be like this. This is a temporary state of affairs. There is better coming. It's from God. It's an evil. And thirdly, there's nothing he can do about it. There's nothing you can do about it. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. If you go for a walk in the woods and grab a stick from the floor and you get your penknife out and you start whittling away, you might better change the outside shape of it. But it is by nature crooked. You can't change its nature, even with your penknife. I understand that you can't ever really straighten curly hair. I don't know. Or perhaps the opposite is true as well. It always just goes, eventually it goes back. You can't change the nature of something that is crooked or wavy and make it straight. And you can't count what isn't there. I can remember a school teacher who thought they were funny, who'd sometimes say at the beginning of a lesson, put your hand up if you're not here. And of course, there would always be a few people who put their hands up and then realise that everyone's else laughing at them. Because of course you can't count was not there. That's ridiculous. You can't count what's lacking. You can't change the nature of things. Life is frustrating. You can't change it. It's from God. And the fourth thing is that that makes even wisdom itself frustrating. Having looked at the world with wisdom, the preacher now, you see, examines the value of wisdom itself. Verse 16, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over at Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also madness and folly, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind, for with much wisdom comes much sorrow, the more knowledge the more grief. So, preacher, is there any advantage from actually being wise? Does being wise get you anywhere? Wisdom has its uses, as we've seen. It helps us to see the world as God has made it. It helps us to see that this frustrating world is from God. That's what wisdom does. But wisdom has its limits. Wisdom can't release you from it. God has laid this evil task on us, and not even wisdom can lighten that task, lighten that burden. Perhaps wisdom could be compared to fine wine. Once you know what wine can taste like and should taste like, everything else tastes like vinegar. My advice, don't get into fine wine. It's too expensive. You can't keep it up, and it really ruins a meal out because you obviously can't afford to buy it. But that's true, isn't it? The more knowledge, the more you appreciate the quality of something, the more you can see something for what it is, the more you can see what isn't like it, and it really ruins your enjoyment of everything else. Ignorance is bliss, isn't it? Why did I ever taste that bottle of wine, whatever else it is? Ignorance sometimes really is bliss. What's the point of all of this? I think it's this. We need to stop trying to make life unpredictable. We need to stop trying to control it. We need to stop buying insurance for every possibility. You know, I was reading about a sports-related insurance policy that was issued in 2006. Someone took out, as a football fan, they took out insurance to cover an English fan from severe trauma if England was eliminated from an early round of the World Cup. One company offers alien abduction insurance. Another, immaculate conception insurance. I have no idea how that works. But, you know, insurance for every possibility. You get it for anything, can't you, nowadays? Now, some insurance is obviously good sense. Pensions are a good idea, especially in our day and age. But here's the point. Don't go thinking that because you've got a fat pension, you're in control of life. You know, save away, that's wise, but you've no idea whether you'll draw a penny. Don't think you can rob life of its shocks and surprises. Don't be lulled into a false sense of security. Ever since Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, we've wanted to be in control, haven't we? Eve was tempted when Satan explained the reason God didn't want them to eat the fruit was because God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. That's the essence of sin, isn't it? It was then, and it is now. That's what happened at Babel. To be like God is our basic desire and orientation, but it's a sin. Give up that project. You can't change and you can't avoid the frustrations in life. You're not God. You never will be God. Thank God. We can't even avoid it by wisdom. Living wisely is obviously not a bad thing, a bad desire. We do want to make wise choices, but we've got to understand that even the wisest choice we make, things may turn out bad. We can't guarantee the outcome, even of wise choices. Wisdom leads us to see we can't control our lives, but it can't control the frustrations of life. Only one thing will do that. Only one thing will get rid of the frustrations of life. A new creation. A new creation is coming. God's promised it. God will bring it. And we wait for it. The juniors are going to go out and discuss what they've heard and think ahead. We're going to hurry on to point two, which is the second thing that wisdom shows us. Wisdom shows us that lasting joy is an illusion. Lasting joy is an illusion. Good to see you were taking notes, Claire. We'll pray for you. Wisdom shows us that lasting joy is an illusion. Firstly, we see that this life does offer genuine joy. Look at verse 1 of chapter 2. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure, or the word there is joy. I'll test you with joy to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness, and what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens. during the few days of their lives. Now, the preacher is not denying that there is genuine joy to be had in life. Now, he goes down the comedy club. He tries alcohol. No doubt they help. And no doubt they do bring some kind of joy. But his point is this, that whatever joy comes is only temporary. Having tasted the joys of this life, he's still left asking this question, what does pleasure or joy accomplish? See, this life does offer genuine joy, and secondly, don't try and recreate Eden, which is going to need some unpacking, but just bear with me. This life offers joy, genuine joy, but it's only temporary, so don't go trying to recreate Eden. You see, he throws himself into projects. I won't read it all out now, we read it earlier, but verse 4, he's throwing himself into vineyards, gardens, parks. He plants fruit trees, water groves, flourishing trees. Then he throws himself into pursuing wealth, slaves, herds, flocks, silver, gold. Then he throws himself into pursuing entertainment, singers, sexual pleasure. It's like he's trying to recreate Eden. One commentator has noted many of the same words. It's amazing when you actually just look at it. In verse 4 to 6, that also appear in Genesis 1 and 2, the verb to plant, the word garden, the phrase all kinds of fruit trees, the verb to irrigate, to sprout, to make and to do. The preacher is trying to recreate Eden, a world within a world. But don't do that, because in verses 10 to 16, it just won't last. Verse 10 is clear, isn't it, about how comprehensive this project was. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. See, it's pleasurable. It's not that it wasn't pleasurable. My heart took delight in all my labour, and this was the reward for all my toil. And yet he still comes to the same conclusion in verse 11. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. When God finished his work of creation, he declared it to be very good. When the preacher surveys his work of new creation, he declares it utterly futile. It was common, apparently, for kings of old to write royal inscriptions boasting of their achievements. Actually, you can go to the Louvre and you can see this, something called the Moabite Stone, which King Misha details his building projects. And even his military victory over Israel, you can read it and you can see the name of King Omri and his son on this kind of stone that's in the Louvre. You can see it. That's what the kind of things they did. They like to boast of their achievements. Came across a poem by Percy Shelley. You might know it. It's called Ozymandias. He highlights the irony of this. Let me read it out to you. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, near them on the sand. Half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty in despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away. Where does all his boasting go? Well, it lasted for a bit, but actually the statue got levelled and all there was sand. And someone has discovered this wreck. The preacher's royal inscription has a very different message. I've achieved this, and I've achieved this, I've done massive things, great projects. Everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. verses 12 to 16 explain why. Death. You see, death levels all of our achievements, doesn't it? Although it's better to live wisely in this world with our eyes open, it's like walking down light rather than a dark place, is what he's saying. There's certainly nothing, they do nothing to prevent death coming. Verse 15, then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also, and then what do I gain? What then do I gain from being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless, for the wise, like the fool, will not be remembered, long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. See, death puts everything into perspective, doesn't it? What is the benefit, he's saying, of being wise? Well, there is benefit, he's saying, but at the end of the day, both die. Now, these verses are not here so that we would copy them. You know, we're not saying, right, okay, that's my experience, right, now you lot go out and try. You know, go and see what you can suck out of life and see how it works for you. Now, he's writing these not so we copy them, but so we would learn from them. Here's a question for us to consider. Are there ways in which I'm trying to recreate Eden in my life, with my life? It could be argued that this is the default position for all humanity. We're trying to get back to Eden somehow. We're trying to build something that is going to be like that, that's going to be permanent, that's going to be where we find our fulfillment. Are we chasing after the things of this world, even in the Christian world, to build our own sense of significance and value? Perhaps it's the pursuit of projects. Perhaps it's the pursuit of a new hobby, perhaps it's trying to be successful at work, perhaps it's trying just to have a laugh, like who can laugh the longest and the loudest. All pleasure. There's nothing wrong with these things in and of themselves, but we've got to be realistic. They won't last. They won't do for us what we want them to do. They won't do what we actually need them to do. In some way, all our attempts to create Eden are attempts to avoid death or to overcome death, but there's only one person who has been able to do that. Listen to what the writer of the Hebrews says of Jesus. Since the children have flesh and blood, Jesus too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. There's only one thing that's going to enable us to escape the fear of death. It's not by recreating our own Eden, by trying to recreate our own eternal life, but accepting the eternal life that comes through the Lord Jesus and his death on the cross so that we might gain. Wisdom teaches us that there is no lasting joy in this life. But thirdly and finally, wisdom does teach us to enjoy life as gift, not gain. And that includes wisdom. Okay, so we're to enjoy and live wisely as gift, not as gain. See, verse 17 begins in rather a depressing way, doesn't it? Oh, so I hated life. Because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of its meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. And verse 22 asks the same question as in chapter 1, verse 3. What's the point? Where does it get you? That's the point, isn't it? If you view the works and activities of your life as gain, as stepping stones to getting ahead in the world, in making your mark on the world, in getting control on the world, in proving that you're really worth something, or you really are somebody, then you're going to end up hating it. There's a terrible story in the Bible, and I hesitate to mention it, but it just illustrates this point perfectly. It's a terrible story in 2 Samuel 13 of a son of a King David called Ammon, who wants to sleep with his stepsister Tamar. You probably know the story. He tricks her. He rapes her, even though she protests and said that she would happily marry him if he would just wait. But he refused to listen to her. After he'd had his way, we're told these words. Then Ammon hated her with an intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. I think that's what's going on, isn't it? It's a graphic story, but it highlights what's going on here. The preacher hates the life that he poured so much into and craved after so much because it failed to do for him what he needed it to do. It failed because it wasn't designed for that. Life was never meant to do that for him. God has frustrated it. Life was never meant to bring him and to do for him what he needed. Both the preacher and the wicked Ammon chose gain over gift and ended up with a deep hatred of the thing they had idealized. Now, I've been reading a couple of cricket biographies, as some of you will know, and we also watched this film called The Edge. I don't know if you haven't seen it and you're into cricket, you must watch it. It's really good, but it's got some swearing in it, so just, you know, here's a caveat for that. But it charts the rise and the success of the England cricket team from number 7 in the world to number 1 under Andy Flower and Andrew Strauss, if you know who they are. But what's striking in all of these things is this, that the anti-climax when they get to the top. What next? What now? That is not enough. I want more. And the extreme hard work and the pressure and the public scrutiny took its toll on the team and even their physical and mental health. There are 30-year-olds who found that when they got there, life was they'd achieved all they could do in life. Their careers were almost over. They'd have to become commentators or something next, or write books and try to earn some money, which, you know, they obviously have because I've bought them. But that's it. When you get to the top of life, when you've achieved everything there is to achieve, meaningless. No, most of us probably won't ever get there to see that, but let's learn from people who have. There is a better way, though, verse 24. That's why the teacher is writing. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This, too, I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This, too, is meaningless. A chasing after the wind. See, there is a better way. The better way is to see the life we live as gift and not gain. A gift to be enjoyed, not a means to a greater end. Take sport, for example. If we do see sport as a way to get ahead, a way to reach fame and fortune, a way to, as a stepping stone or kind of a pedestal on which we can just like show our prowess and our human achievement, well, that's gain. It'll disappoint us. Even if you achieve something, it'll eat you up and you'll end up hating it. No, sport is a gift to enjoy for its own sake. If we see work or study or proficiency in music or children or and a family or a husband or a wife or friends or even a role in church as a way of establishing our own prominence or fame or a name, then we're using it for gain. You'll end up disappointed and disillusioned and you'll hate the thing that you once loved. I was at a conference, as you know, most of you do, about Ecclesiastes, and we were learning about these things, and afterwards an older guy sat next to me, and he asked me about my life and, you know, who I had a wife and children. I said yes, and he asked me this question: do you enjoy them? Do you enjoy your family? It's a challenging question, isn't it? I think particularly as parents, you know, when you have your first child, shock, you know, life has changed a lot. And you can end up thinking, oh, you know, life will get back to normal when they're sleeping through the night. No. Life will get back to normal when they're out of nappies. Life will get to normal when they're all at school. Life will get to, no. No, it doesn't, does it? And before you know it, 10 years are gone. And you haven't enjoyed the season that God has given you at that time. See, these things are not, they're not gain, they're not there for our gain. They're a gift from God for us to enjoy. See, there's a difference, isn't there, between the person who considers the short life and says, eat, drink, and merry, for tomorrow we die, and a person who says, eat, drink, and merry, because today is gift, or something like that. You know, I don't know how to... David Gibson, in his book on Ecclesiastes, says this: some say eat, drink, and merry because that's all there is. The teacher says eat, drink, and merry because that's what there is. Life is gift, not gain. Now, it's the other thing, just to end, it's not that enjoyment of life is simply an option. You know, it's not like, you know, actually, as long as I don't love life too much, you know, that's all right. But actually, I'm really, not really, I don't really like life. I find everything hard. But, you know, that's kind of, there's a godliness about that kind of, you know, I'm not really attached to life. But actually, that's not the way the Bible sees it. Seems to me that enjoyment of life is not simply an option. It's actually a command. When we view the world rightly with wisdom, when we understand it's God's given limitations, when we understand that these things that we have are God's gift for us, whether we kind of really, you know, would have chosen that or not, it seems to me that joy is natural. Have you got a job? Thank God. Do your work with gratitude. Are you working hard at study? Great. Enjoy that. Thank God for it. You're doing your best to be a parent. Is that hard work? Well, thank God for that. Enjoy it. Don't use them as stepping stones. Don't use them as a platform for showing how great you are or whatever. But enjoy them for what they are. I've been reading through Colossians. It strikes me that it's full of gratitude. Just listen to these couple of verses in closing. This is Paul's instructions. Whatever you do, that is, I think that's pretty comprehensive. Whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to the Father, to God the Father, through him. Colossians 3 again. Whatever you do, again, pretty comprehensive, work at it with all of your heart, as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving.